Explode your to-be-read pile with the New Release Index, your new best friend for finding the best new books. Curated by the book nerds here at Book Riot, it will help you keep track of the upcoming books we think should be on your radar. You can filter by genre, what's trending among other subscribers, and save books to your own watch list. And you can check out the demo at bookriot.com/new-releases. That's bookriot.com/new-releases. Happy browsing!
Well, 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 we're back, ready to rock and roll.
We are.
Let's see, what are we doing right now? The last episode that was released to the feed was Buy, Sell, Hold of 2020. Mm-hmm. I hope you enjoyed that. The stinger at the end was a preview of our next bonus episode coming out in a couple days. Which Amanda Nelson will be joining Rebecca and I to. We don't really have much of a structure right now, but we're going to talk about the pilot of The West Wing as a pilot in itself, but then The West Wing is a cultural phenomenon. I think a lot of us are re-wading into the pools of possibility and optimism politically, and there is no warmer bath for that, for those of us of a certain political persuasion, than The West Wing. I think Amanda is beginning a rewatch. We might do some other episodes around it. We'll see how it goes. But like for people of our-ish age, right? You guys are a little bit younger than I am, but it's a foundational civics document, I think, in a way that's kind of hard to explain, I think, to people that don't get
it. I think that's true. And I came late to it, you know, like I didn't watch it when it was first airing, but I think we were talking about this offline. A not small percentage of the things that I understand about how American government works, I understand, like, specifically because of The West Wing.
Right. One of the pleasures of it is you learn a little something along the way, you know? And there are problems with The West Wing. The pilot, you know, it is a 21-year-old document at this point. And among liberalism and the left, it's been a very important 20 years for how people on the left understand the world. So I think that will be interesting, but also as a artistic document, we look forward to it. It's something we all are interested in. It's not really bookish, though it kind of, maybe it's whatever. We're going to do it because we want to. What is a bonus? You don't want to listen to it, don't listen to it.
Yeah, I think it falls into that class of TV show that you can read in some way.
Yes, right.
In the way that we talked about reading Mad Men. So I'm feeling just fine about doing some episodes.
No, it's our show. Get your own podcast. But Sorkin starts out as a playwright. It's very writerly. It's probably the most writerly of any mainstream TV show. Certainly just regular. I mean, that's not NBC. This is network. This is not HBO. This is not even AMC in the Mad Men world. Very interesting in that regard. Now I'm spoiling all my notes about how to think about what's going on there. But if you want to rewatch the pilot ahead of time, great. If not, that's what we're going to do. We will talk about all West Wing things. So if you don't want to be spoiled, I would watch out there. But that's what we're going to do next. What else is coming up on the bonus episode train? I don't have it in front of me.
We are also going to have our favorite books of 2020, just you and me, the ones we liked this year, the ones that we happened to read and like this year.
Mine's going to be a super weird list. I'm so sorry ahead of time.
I'm really ready for your super weird list.
Very strange list.
Yeah, I just kind of got back on the front list train a couple of months ago after I spent, you know, all summer hanging out with E.B. White. So mine is going to be an interesting list also. But if you have favorite books of 2020 that you want to tell us about, you can do that at podcast@bookriot.com. And then we'll get into our moms, dads, and not moms, dads, and grads.
Holidays.
It's not the spring anymore. Our holiday recommendation show. So you can still send us your requests also at podcast@bookriot.com.
I haven't done a count. I got another wave after the last episode. I'm pretty sure that if you still email us now, you're going to get you have a fair shot of making air with your recommendation request. Got a couple tough ones, but sometimes these don't take very long because we do our homework and then we don't have anything to say about them because we don't know the books. So those sometimes go quicker. All right, let's do a quick break and I've got some follow-up and there are some news things going on this week.
Good deal.
Explode your to-be-read pile with the New Release Index, your new best friend for finding the best new books. Curated by the book nerds here at Book Riot, it will help you keep track of the upcoming books we think should be on your radar. You can filter by genre, what's trending among other subscribers, and save books to your own watch list. And you can check out the demo at bookriot.com/new-releases. That's bookriot.com/new-releases. Happy browsing!
A follow-up. You know, I'm sorry. I wrote down this in my notes, but I didn't actually capture who wrote us to say this. So this is regarding to our, I'd say fairly vociferous castigations of Publishers Weekly for having only one adult list. The reason we thought it was weird they only have one adult list is because they don't only have one adult list. If you navigate to the link, and I'll do a link in the show, Publishers Weekly Best Book of 2020. In our defense, the UX is a problem because, like, you go in, and this is very.
I'm clicking
very,
on it right now.
So go. I'm not looking at it. I'll walk you through it. Podcasters, theater of the mind, Rebecca. So everyone can imagine us browsing the internet together. You go there, and you see there's the cover of the issue, and then there's the the full list or the top 10, and then there's the kids red button, right?
Yeah.
You see that? Now, let your eyes drift up to that weird bar of black, gray on black categories. Click on
that. Oh. Got it. So, those...
It is... So, it's not an editorial problem. Like, they did the thing we want them to do. But from a user experience point of view, I didn't even see that. It looks like just categories for random stuff on the page. You can't navigate it to another way. It's not like the children's books are arranged when you get to those. So, I will take some of the blame. Right.
It looks like the top site nav.
Yeah, it looks like nav. It looks like site nav. It doesn't look like list nav. That's exactly right. That's a good way of putting it. So.
Okay, well, I stand by my fist shaking then.
Well, we will redirect our fist shaking from the reviewing strategy to the UX experience.
Yeah. These are still interesting lists, though. I clicked on the fiction list, and it is following that. Following that pattern that we had identified from the top 10 of mostly not big, flashy, popular books of the year, which I'm really happy to see. There is a lot of interesting stuff here and several that I hadn't heard of. So I'm glad that that seems to be consistent, at least. Yeah. Interesting list. Okay. Well,
Publishers Weekly does a lot of things well. They're the only ones that do what they do. And we talk about a lot of their reporting over there. I really admire what they do. Uh-huh. It's a very difficult job. Their user experience on the site hasn't changed in a while.
Yeah. Thank you to whoever set us straight about this. I never would have gotten there on my own.
the person I remember was a little, they were a little incredulous that we didn't see it. Cause like, but they're there. And I'm like, wait, they're there. And I went back and I was like, where? And I really had to do some sleuthing of like, just click. I was like, because, it's dark gray on black. I mean, it's a tough
it's
beat.
Not...
I mean, I wanted to... Look, we could have done our homework, and I'm not Maggie Haberman here. I don't know what to tell you. I was just looking at the thing. Both of us were looking for it and still couldn't find it. That's all you need
I
to know.
Our confusion is evidently genuine in that episode.
That is a fair... That's a very fair thing to say. We've got some... Just a quick other things, but, you know, the my follow-up notes, things that didn't make it into your show notes. Mm. There's a scene we talked about in Jurassic Park, one of the great scenes in film, when they're in the Jeeps and the power's off and they hear the steps of the T-Rex coming, and you see those little shockwaves in the glasses. That's what's happening this week in books, and the T-Rex is Obama's A Promised Land because there's a lot of stuff going on around it right now. Uh-huh. Maybe we're even seeing the eyes of the T-Rex. Don't move. He can't see if you don't move. I mean, maybe we're frozen in front of the modified Ford Explorer. A couple of things. One is Oprah got the big interview for her for her Apple TV Plus series. Not a surprise, I guess.
Nope.
I'm sure he will be doing other things. Some of the audio excerpts have leaked. Penguin Random House released some of the audio. You know, if you've listened to any, we've all heard Obama talk. It's not a surprise, but... It's out there too. And the thing I was most interested to see, were there going to be reviews ahead of time? I didn't know if there were review copies or not. The Times at least has one. And did you see this?
No, I didn't. I saw an excerpt from the book earlier today, but I did not see the Times review. Tell me.
Well, let me play this game. Since we don't have a lot of news, we can just play around a little bit too, because normally we're just straight and narrow us all the time. But Give me your top five picks for who you want to read. Whose review of Obama's memoir do you want?
Oh, God. This assumes that I know who the New York Times reviewers are.
No, it could be anybody. This is freelance. Oh. You got the whole, let's say they're alive, but that's about the only bounds you have, right?
Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Okay, Coates is one. I got putting that on the board. I'm like Vanna White now. I'm putting your letters on the board. Okay.
Okay. Marilyn. Okay. Although they might be too friendly for her to review his book, but it's not like that's ever stopped people before. So I want Marilyn Robinson's thoughts on the Obama book.
That's not a problem in the book reviewing world, generally speaking.
Okay, and we're doing our wishes, not like court of rightness about it. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. I would love...
You're not guessing here. I don't want you to guess. I want to hear who you would
like. I'm thinking about it. I think Roxane Gay would be obvious. Actually, no, I want Tressie McMillan Cottom's review of this. And maybe somebody who crosses between like the social justice and religious communities.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I wonder who that would be.
Like a
Claudia Rankine kind of person?
A Claudia Rankine or like a, there was a, not Baptist. There was an Episcopal bishop on Brené Brown's podcast recently.
Oh, yeah. I remember. I know who you're talking about.
I think
about.
His name is Michael Curry. Yeah, I might be wrong. I think his name is Michael Curry. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would, and his book is about like hope and kindness. I would like a review like that.
Okay.
I don't want a Dwight Garner review of the Obama book.
It's none of those. It's none of the usual, you know, bespectacled suspects.
Jesmyn Ward.
It's a good. That's a good pick too.
I would take a Jesmyn Ward review or a Tyari Jones review or like Kiese Layman. Mm-hmm.
You're getting warmer. You're warmer into the actual guessing. Yeah, I think Coates is who I would pick. I think Coates would be my number one overall draft pick too. Someone you may know, Chimam.
Interesting.
And I read the first and I read the first and last because I wanted a taste of, you know, what is this? You know, I knew it would be good, but like how good? And let me just say the first, I don't have it in front of me because it's paywalled and I'm on my desktop. I only have the app on my phone. God, Jesus. But the first line is like, Barack Obama is like, one of the great living writers or something like that. What's the line?
Barack Obama is as fine a writer as they come.
And that's not for politicians. That's not like grading on a curve. That's just straight up. And it's true. He's just a wonderful writer.
Yeah.
And then I read
the
very
sentence is good too.
Yeah. Don't read Go ahead.
Okay. Here's the second sentence.
Yeah.
It is not merely that this book avoids being ponderous, as might be expected, even forgiven, of a hefty memoir, but that it is nearly always pleasurable to read, sentence by sentence, the prose gorgeous in places, the detail granular and vivid.
Are you beyond the paywall?
Yeah, I'm beyond the paywall.
Go to the end and read about how, start after, so Michelle Obama tells him, there's a couple quotes from Michelle Obama, but then start after her last quote at the end, remembering this right.
Okay. Early in the relationship, Michelle asks why he always chooses the hard way. Later, she tells him, it's like you have a hole to fill. That's why you can't slow down.
Johnny Ringo.
Indeed.
Go ahead.
Indeed. Here, then, is an overwhelmingly decent man giving an honest account of himself. It is now normal to preface any praise of a public figure with the word flawed, but who isn't flawed? As a convention, it feels like an ungracious hedge, a churlish reluctance to commend the powerful or famous, no matter how well-deserved. The story will continue in the second volume, but Barack Obama has already illuminated a pivotal moment in American history and how America changed while also remaining unchanged.
There you go.
Damn. I love a review that's actually enjoyable to read.
And it's long. There's a lot, too. I mean, you probably have noticed in scrolling from top to
bottom. I had to scroll a lot.
Yeah. So I'm saving that for after I get through the whole book, but it's making me even more excited. I was definitely interested, but I think this moves my needle. Whoa. from merely interested to quite excited. Is this labeled clean? What do we need to do here?
Look, it wasn't weird until you said, whoa.
Look, I've always got the HR scanner going.
he was born with the HR scanner.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we were talking about how we're both going to read it in hardcover, and maybe we would do a discussion of that. I feel like we're going to book club our way through this one.
I think we are too. It's 768. I don't know. Do we do the whole thing at once? I'm not sure what to do, but I'm now and firmly in the camp of being excited about this. And yeah, I mean, I'm not sure what else to say. Secondary question. Let's do a sponsor. And I've got another question for you. Chimamanda, I don't know that it would have, I think my list looks like yours. It would have taken me a while to think of her.
Yeah.
But I hoped I would have at the beginning, but I think she would have immediately shot up my draft board. I think I want her more than Marilyn, frankly. I want her more than Jesmyn Ward because she has an insider outsider kind of thing that's going on. She's a beautiful writer herself. Anyway, these will all be wonderful picks, but it got me thinking. Writers that book nerds like us know by just their first name. Like, she's got a unique one, right? So that's easier, but also whatever. She has her own vibe. Here's who I have right now. And these are living writers.
Okay.
Ta-Nehisi. Coulson.
Yep.
I've got, let's see, who's it? There's someone else. Oh, Tony, but we know who we're talking about, but she's dead. I think I had one. I can't even read my own handwriting. Is that it? That might be it. Yeah, I think that's, what writers can you say just their first name? Now, these people are wonderful writers, but also have a distinctive first name. You have some problems in other situations, like when people used to talk about Jonathan Franzen, and you couldn't just say Jonathan.
Right.
You could, because there's Jonathan Saffron Foer and there's Jonathan Lethem. Like, there was, we're lousy with Jonathans back in the early 2000s. But there are some people, like if you're talking about basketball and you talk about Michael, it doesn't matter how many Michaels are because you know which Michael you're talking about. I don't even think Franzen got to the lead of the Jonathans. Like, you still were like, you had to do some disambiguation around Jonathan there. So there might be people out there now where, who do you know? Who can you say just their first name? You can't say Stephen. If I say Stephen, do you know who I'm talking about?
I would assume it's Stephen King.
Yeah, right. But you would say King.
Right.
Is there anybody else?
There are very few. I guess I'm going to call these the Madonna writers, like the one name. There are very few of those, yeah.
Unless you have a distinctive name and are, you know, the top tier, which, you know, that's the Ta-Nehisis and the Jesmyns and the Chimamandas do. Or Zadie's another one. Zadie. Everyone knows who you're talking
about. Zadie, yeah.
That was the one I couldn't read my handwriting when I was like, what am I saying? Codley? No, that's a Z, dummy. But I don't think there's a Michael Jordan is what I'm trying to say. I'm not there saying, for our world, there's not a Michael.
I agree.
Is there?
I don't think so.
Podcast at bookriot.com. Danielle? You know I'm talking about Steele? Do you know?
Oh, no. I was like,
I'm just thinking of the gold, the embossed
people.
Maybe
Nora, like Nora Roberts.
Nora Roberts. That's interesting. But you wouldn't just say Nora. You'd say Nora Roberts.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I think we might be the wrong generation to have a one-name reference to Nora, but I would believe that, like, our moms maybe talked to their friends about reading Nora's new book.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm just looking at some general lists, just like, who do you even... Like, people that sell a bunch of books. Maybe if you say Malcolm, my first thought is Malcolm X. Malcolm Gladwell is the living writer that sells the most books. Like, Sedaris, you say Sedaris. David is too general.
Yeah.
Like, it's
we mostly know these people by their last names, yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if, like, Margaret, for Margaret Atwood. Getting closer. Anyway, I just thought that was notable. I thought there was a day where if you said Ernest, like in the 20s, or if you said, who am I trying to think of now? Oh, come on. James Michener. I think there was a point where Michener sold so many books that if you said James Michener, people forget. Well, actually, people don't forget. They just don't ever know. Michener moved units like nobody. He moved weight like nobody else. in the 60s and 70s. So I thought it was a kind of a fun thing because I knew I could say Chimamanda and you're like, oh.
Right.
But I was like, who else could I do that with? Marilyn, maybe? Roxanne,
Oprah. Yeah, it's
Oprah.
It's interesting. Or, you know, Glennon. But Glennon Doyle is like a
Glennon
figure. Glennon. And there's that. She's a cultural figure and it's a distinctive first name. And I feel that way about Brené, you know.
Yeah, I was going to say Brené is the one in our parlance. You can say Brené. And some of that is a last name. If you said Brown, you're like, Brown.
Right.
There's too many Browns.
We just don't have monoculture anymore where everybody's reading the same 20 big books every year and talking about them in that way.
Yeah, if you go back to maybe the heyday of the Barnes & Noble bestseller, kind of like the Tom Clancy's, the John Grisham's, the Mike, Tom, John, and Michael, like, good luck. It's just like, pick which white guy you want to, you know, like, pick a white name out of a hat.
I mean, that's how those bestseller lists work anyways.
Well, that's what the hegemony of naming convention and list coalesces to form an undifferentiated morass of prejudice.
That
and
is
boringness.
Just a sentence.
It's really coming out now, Rebecca. It's really flowing at this point. All right, I'm fascinated to see. I think I wouldn't mind seeing. I mean, surely multi-perspective voices around here. Chimamanda,
well, you know,
pretty good.
We're going to do a bonus episode about the Obama memoir, probably part of the research, we'll be reading a bunch of the interesting reviews. That'll just be such work, Jeff. It's like how right now I'm reading oral histories of the West Wing. It's awful.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm trying to think now. I think there's also part of me that would like a scholarly, like the Michael Eric Dyson, Henry Louis Gates.
Oh, Michael Eric Dyson. Yes. Yeah.
One of those people. One of my
Michael
old professors
Eric?
At Columbia University, Farah Jasmine Grissom, who's a literary critic too, who writes beautifully about writing and popular culture. Someone like that. Who, again, the venue matters. Like, I'm sure an academic historical journal would write something different than the New York Times Review, New York Times Book Review, which is still the review of record.
Yeah. This is out of left field, but I'm watching the new series, or I've been watching the new drop. There's only four episodes of the Letterman interview series on Netflix, which I really love.
Right.
He's a good interviewer. And there's one with Dave Chappelle, who has done some writing in the last couple of years and is one of, I think, like the contrast of Chappelle and Obama in the way that they address things is really interesting. And I would love a Dave Chappelle review of the Obama book.
Ibram Kendi is probably the one I would pick. Right. I mean, that's where you want to go from there. But I'll read it again. If it's as good as would probably expect. And then these early indications are, that it holds force on this promise. I guess the one thing I have many things in mind as I'm reading, thinking about it, and the principle among those is what we were talking about before we knew the outcome of the election, is to read it with that duality in mind of how would this have read in the bad place?
You know? Right.
Because the book is done. The book is the book, right? They're not changing anything depending on the election. Mm-hmm. So was he writing for posterity? How much was he writing for knowing that people would be getting this book, you know, a mere 2 weeks after the election? I'd be curious to hear. Maybe you say write it as if there were no election, but how do you do that? How do you do that? I don't know. It seems impossible.
Yeah,
so I'm fascinated with
that
situation.
I don't know that you could
situation.
Do that. Be interesting. Yeah.
So anyway, what else we got? Coates' name came up. So
yeah,
let's talk
about
Coates.
News this week. So, and I'm kind of surprised we hadn't heard about that. This hadn't happened sooner, but Oprah's Harpo Films production company has teamed up with Brad Pitt's Plan B production company, and they are going to develop and release an adaptation of Between the World and Me. Oh, sorry, they did Between the World and Me. They're going to do The Water Dancer.
The Water Dancer, yeah.
So I think that's going to be interesting. You know, we did book club The Water Dancer, and there are some messy things in the novel that I think you could solve with good screenwriting. Like, I was thinking back on this, that one of the big problems with the book, one of the weaknesses, I'll say, because it's not like a big problem, but one of the weaknesses of the book is characters that have like very long monologue, sort of navel gazing moments, or very long internal monologue moments. And you can't just do that on screen for 90 minutes or 2 hours.
No.
But there's a lot of beautiful stuff that happens in the book, and the story itself is really interesting. So I am more excited about the concept of The Water Dancer now, thinking about it as a film. And I think it has a shot to be one of those situations where the adaptation is better than the source material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's very, very reasonable. And also a screenplay can do some things differently, but then a director, mm-hmm. you can do some things differently about how that's all going to shake out. I wonder if Brad Pitt himself, I mean, he has his own production company. I wonder if he's going to play. There is a part for Brad Pitt in this movie that
mm-hmm.
is an unflattering look. But Brad Pitt, he doesn't. I was thinking about this. Brad Pitt villain. Does any role jump off? Do you know of a? Mm-mm. Can you think of a Brad Pitt villain role?
Off
the top of your head, don't IMDb it. I didn't. So
mm-mm. No. I
because DiCaprio. DiCaprio did a turn as a terrible, I mean, slave owners are terrible,
yeah.
but especially bad, you know, caricature, over the top. Seemed like he was really going for it in Django Unchained, the Quentin Tarantino. There is mm-hmm. a similar kind of a role in Water Dancer that Pitt could play. He'd be interesting to see him do that. But to my, I can't think of Pitt as the bad guy. I can't think of one thing, and I would like to see it in any case.
I would like
here,
to
would be
see it,
too.
I think it would be really interesting. Yeah, he does weird roles, you know, like mm-hmm. he's done plenty weird, unusual things, but I've never seen him just as a straight up bad guy.
Yeah. Anyway, there, I've got a little email from the listener saying they really got on the horse because responding to the buy, sell, and hold, saying they thought that was really interesting. They were wondering how much of what we think the notable books of the year are line up with bestsellers. And I was like, that's an interesting question. And we will get the bestsellers of the year data towards the end. I went back and found the mid-year bestsellers of the bestsellers. And zero of the adult titles we talked about are in the top 20.
Yeah. I was going to be surprised if it was more than like 10%.
Well, John Bolton's A Room Where It Happened, we threw into the category of Trump books. So I'll give us credit for that.
Okay.
The other thing you have to remember about best-selling books is we were talking about things released in 2020. And a lot of the best-selling books, even if they meet the year criteria where they get to be a year on these things, were released in 2019. So you got to remember, we're talking Crawdads is still eligible.
Right.
That's the number one mid-year. We're talking Becoming by Michelle Obama. Mm-hmm. We're talking The Little Fires Everywhere adaptation was out.
Right.
Unfortunately, that one book that we did a pre-thing saying we're not going to talk about it, but, you know, whatever, that book is on this list. The Boy, the Mole, and the Fox, and the Horse, which we talked about, which is the Barnes & Noble Book of the Year pick, was still on this list. You get a Grisham. Okay. You get a Stephen King.
Do you get like a big lifestyle kind of book?
Yeah. Well, the number two book is Magnolia Table Volume 2.
There it is.
Right, by the Joanna Gaines. You get Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility and How to Be an Anti-Racist. Those are earlier releases that were in the middle of the white hot center of the reemergence of Black Lives Matter and the movement in the summertime. So there you go. I don't know that any of the books we talked about. Well,
yeah.
Obama's book is going to come flying out of the gate. So I would be shocked if it's not on the top 20 by the time we get there.
And maybe if we look at year-end, like, hardcover bestsellers, we might have some overlap of, like, what were the new release hardcovers that did well. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know what the long tail of, like, The Vanishing Half has been, but I think it hit the bestseller list when it first came out.
Yeah.
Nonfiction, I don't think we're going to have anything there.
The number 20 the number 20 adult title in June or July was So You Want to Talk About Race. It sold 201,000 copies. I don't think Vanishing Half, Deacon King Kong, none of those novels that we really liked. Now, notable, are people going to care about it in the future is different than now, because I think people aren't going to care as much about, I'm just putting something out there, The Room Where It Happened, right? That's a number three that sold half a million copies. It's not going to age well. The Four Agreements, one of these business books. Burn After Writing, The Five Love Languages. I mean, The Tattooist of Auschwitz is a paperback barn burner. Like, that's one of the great success stories of the last few years in adult fiction. If we jump down to the YA side, Ballads of Songbirds and Snakes we had on our list. Midnight Sun hadn't come out yet. That will be on the best-selling books of the year list. Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, I didn't remember this. I knew it flew out. In July, it had sold 887,000 units, which is number one, by 150,000 over Crawdads. The number two YA, Chain of Gold by Cassandra Clare. You want to guess the units on that one, the number two in July?
No, I don't.
124. I don't even want to try. So that's a seven spot that Collins did on Clare. Then Stamped by Jason Reynolds and Kendi was number three. That I would assume would be remain on the list. The Giver, The Hate You Give, One of Us is Lying, Conference Birds, Live, The Side of Line.
Okay.
All of those I could see being passed. Midnight Sun.
Let me think it.
Go ahead.
I think it goes to a bigger point that, like, the best sellers of a year are rarely the things that endure
for
the long haul.
Yeah. So we weren't really trying. I guess, are there any books on this list, is what I was thinking, that we maybe should have put on here? There were new things that came out. The one that I was looking at is Eric Larson's The Splendid and the Vile. Which Larson's books sell, and, and people read, they go back and read the whole thing, like Dave McCullough or Sedaris or someone else like that. Mm-hmm. Sedaris has a book out that we didn't talk about. It's a new one that's out this week. But I think it's hard to differentiate one Sedaris from another. Like, it's a David Sedaris book, not what was that book by David Sedaris. It's just different.
I think this might be a David Sedaris clip show also. I'm not sure it's new material.
Who knows, right? Who can tell?
Does it even matter?
Yeah. Doesn't matter. I love David Sedaris, but will I know that I remember listening to that one? It's like, that's a compliment and a slam, and I get, or I don't know. He has a thing that he does, and he's great, and no one does anything like what he does.
Yeah.
I will listen to every David Sedaris audiobook that I can, 100. But ask me to name seven of them, like, I can... You know, what are they about? What do they mean? I don't know. It just is.
Try to remember which story is from which David Sedaris book.
Like, good luck. Good night, nurse. Yeah. No way. I'm trying to think of what else here. Yeah, I don't see anything else. I think the YA version of Stamped is maybe one we could have say we slept on. Because I think that book's going to be taught and used and talked about. I don't tend to think of the YA version of these of adult books as being something I care about, but that one serves a real role that teachers and librarians and parents, frankly, are looking for. And I think that's going to age very well over time as being useful. So that's one we could have, if I had the opportunity to hold or buy on Stamped, I would have. It was not, I'm selling everything else. I'm selling the Kobe Bryant book. I mean, get out of here with this stuff. I'm not sorry about that. I'm selling The Boy, the Mole, the Fox, and the Horse. Are we really going to think that's going to be amongst the Mount Rushmore of, like, picture illustrated Where the Wild Things? Is it going to be Where the Wild Things Are? Because it's selling like it's going to be Where the Wild Things Are. And you will lose a lot of money betting books are going to join the children's...
Wait, it's a children's Rushmore. Book?
Is Where the Wild Things Are a children's book? Do kids like Where the Wild Things Are is a better question. I'm serious. That's not a joke. Parents like Where the Wild Things Are. In my experience of trying to read that book to kids, they're like, what in the hell is happening? What kind of adult nostalgia pain nonsense is this?
Adult nostalgia pain nonsense. This is how little I know about The Boy, the Fox, the whatever is.
Yeah, horse, like, the boy, the cup, the horse, the turn, the leaf, the screw. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was, I thought this was like adult fiction.
No one wants to ride the train with me of how weird of a pick that was and how weird it is that sells. It's
100% weird.
Yeah.
It's weird.
But anyway.
Have any of you read it? Please email us and tell us why.
Because I haven't read the whole thing. I thumbed through it at Powell's in the before times. Boy, would I love to go go hate read or just skeptical read. Maybe I'd love it. I don't know. I'm a weird guy. I like things. Who knows?
I'm reading the jacket copy on the interweb right now, and I can see why what the pitch is. Like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Asked the mole. kind, said the boy. So inspiration and hope in uncertain times, following the tale of a curious boy, a greedy mole, a wary fox, and a wise horse, find themselves in difficult terrain. It's like if Brené Brown wrote a novel.
Yeah, I was like, what if Aesop had read Who Moved My Cheese? That's what I feel
right,
like with this thing.
Spiritual cheese. Like, are you supposed to read this with your kids? Or are you supposed to just read it?
This is what I'm saying. Okay, so if you've read this, email us at podcast@bookriot.com. Give us your 4-sentence review. Also, what is your experience of reading Where the Wild Things Are to children? Does that go great for you? Are librarians like, you know what I'm going to rip out today on this rainy day? Where the Wild Things Are. I think that's more of a, I think it's like an adult, like I throw myself in there. Like this is, I don't know. I want to play opera for you. That's what it feels
like. Yeah. Like, okay, so I've Googled The Boy, the Whatever, and it's the Amazon listing shows it ranking in literary graphic novels, philosophy of ethics and morality, and happiness self-help. So, like, if that's your bedtime reading with your kids, I'm sorry to them, I guess.
It's like The Giving Tree. It's like, yeah, I guess, but also no, don't do that.
Are we going to have our rant about The Giving Tree?
Oh, you know, that stump will be there. We can come back to that whenever we want. Spoiler alert. What am I doing? We're talking about books. We're trying to connect best-selling books to notable and using the bestseller list as sort of a filter. It's like there's anything we really missed. I don't think so. I mean, there's another Dogman 8. That one going to stick out from the crowd? Diary of a Wimpy Kid 14? My kid loved those books. That's great for kids. Kids love to read them. Thrilled they're there, but like, it's not the first or the last. Yeah, right.
Number 672, yeah.
If we're the first or the last, maybe we can have a conversation. But first, we wouldn't know it's a phenomenon. And will we know it's the last one? There you go. So,
wow, that got very deep all of a sudden.
Let's take one last break and do a couple more news things, then we'll get out of here. Well, speaking of the book, the news stories that we could have had headlines from in 2015 and talked about, I thought this would be better by now. I'm naive. You know, I'm just letting myself up to be disappointed. I also don't do a lot of children's books. We're kind of out of that. We're into middle grade and YA, and that kind of doesn't come in here. But UK children's books, 8 times more likely to feature animals than characters of color, which is not great. But also, there are a lot of books about animals. Like, what's the ratio of books about animals to books about real people, I guess, as a baseline? This is still not what you want. But we were just talking about a boy with the horse, the mole, and the turtle, and the whatever. 9 of those things are animals. 1 is a boy.
The only upside is that this is from a UK study that's done every year. And in 2017, it was 1%. So now
we're up 10x.
2020, it's 5%.
Oh, 5%, 5%.
Yeah, 5% now of children's books have Black, Asian, or minority ethnic protagonists, which, you know, they are talking about UK books, so they abbreviate the collective of marginalized groups a little bit differently than we do. So that's like 5x improvement in 2 years is pretty good, but like, please keep that going.
Yeah. It's good and bad. I mean, the good part is 1 to 5%. I think we should be hard peddling that. The office of self peddling is hard peddling that. Like that is a big deal, but it's not enough.
Right. If you go from if they can keep this 5x thing and go from 5% to 25% in the next couple of
five years, whatever. You know.
Yeah. If you do that, you're still under the overall proportional representation of people of color, but 25% is much better than 1%, and to go from 1% to 25 in a handful of years would be really great. Then just keep on going. More info about that in this Guardian piece by Allison Flood, but that's the top line.
Yeah, I guess we probably covered this 2017 story, or like thing was done. Yeah. If you had said, "Will you take 1 to 5% in 3 years? Would you sign for that right now?"
Yeah,
I think I probably would have. 3 years ago. Now, I wouldn't have said, now we're done, but I'd say, quintupling in 3 years? I think that's a win. I'm going to take that as a good nine holes, maybe. You know, we're not done, but there's some more golf to do, but so far, so good with that improvement there. I'm looking at other listener feedback. I don't have a lot of recommendation requests for ourselves this year. which
good. I like that.
We have over time hit the please, please don't feel bad about asking you for yourself. So we have causal density here. But
your new favorite phrase.
My new favorite. I love. Go Google that for. Go Google. Do yourself a favor and Google that. So I'm not sure if we have encouraged this, or people are like, you know what? I want my own my own recommendations.
Whatever. Treat yourself. This year.
The only other segment I had for you, Rebecca, is would you like to hear anonymized, hashed things publishers are seeing in 2021? I've been on 20-ish sales calls with some of our sales folks over the last 2 weeks, and I can't name imprints, even specific titles. But would you like to hear the few takeaways I'm hearing from multiple people? Would you like to do that?
I would. Yes, I would. What would you have done if I'd said no?
You can find show notes at bookriot.com. I don't know.
I've been surprised.
I would have been hurt and surprised. No, I'm kidding.
I would never leave you in your rhetorical anecdata question.
Yeah.
Out in the cold.
Number one with a bullet. I think this is the thing we're hearing from most people that they were saying, cautious optimism for 2021.
Cautious optimism.
I think that's warranted. We've seen the numbers of book sales go up.
Mm-hmm.
They're holding steady now. Holiday season, no bookstores, stimulus money's run out. I think everyone's like, well, what about now? But I think everyone that we talked to was didn't want to say over the moon with how things went, considering what they thought they could have been in, you know, on March 18th, right?
Right.
When everyone's going, schools are closing and people are losing their jobs, like publishing was one of the winners. Publishing. Now, I'm not saying bookstores, not saying that, but publishing has done very, very well. So that's one. I think I told you this one already, but in normal times, debut fiction, I mean, only harder than poetry to sell, debut fiction.
Right, yes.
Especially tough now. People are reading and rereading. They're buying, but they're rereading backlist, old favorites, books by authors they've known but maybe never picked up before. You know, they're going to pick up Lila by Marilynne Robinson, for example, or something like that. Or for not that that's one people mentioned, but we were talking about backlist too, like people doing stuff like that. Debut fiction is insanely hard to move. You and I talked about on the buy, sell, holds, feeling very sorry for the people who are who got their break. I've got a book coming out. I spent 3 years doing it. It's been my dream to write a book. And it didn't sell, and they got their book tour canceled, and they did some Zoom calls with their local indie, and that's a tough beat.
Yeah.
Very tough beat. On the other hand, backlist, even more. One of the secrets we know and we talk about and say, do you guys know this? We scream about how people don't know this to be a secret. The percentage of books that are actually backlist, that actually comprise dollars that are into the book economy.
So many.
Is insane. And one of the reasons the bestseller lists choose to crowd out books that have come out more than a year ago is because it'd be hard to find a new release on that list. For the first time, I'm hearing some major publishers in a serious way talk about, and this intersects with our business, how to spend marketing dollars around backlist. How would you do it? What would you do? This is something we've been beating our heads against forever. Finally now. It's like, you know what? It's hard to sell debut fiction. People are buying backlist. Maybe we should give a little bit lift to that. That will only make it harder, I think, to sell debut fiction if you're taking some. So I don't know. There's a unvirtuous circle. There's a sinful square, I guess, is the opposite of an unvirtuous circle. There's a sinful square that could happen in that kind of a situation. So that's one thing I'm hearing as well. There's a little bit of an A-B test the universe thing of people like,
okay,
well, what if we didn't send people on these expensive book tours and they met with 10 people in 9 different cities over 3 weeks that cost $10,000 and maybe sold 58 copies direct in those bookstores? People trying digital events of all kinds and Zooms and Instagram Lives. One of the questions I had is that what people were telling us in March and April when I did a round of calls around the same time. This one's like, I think this is going to be part of the future, even in the after times of COVID, that we've been wondering about the utility of the mid-list book tour, And I wonder if that the reign of that is going to be significantly downplayed. And you're going to be doing Zoom calls, digital events, YouTube things people are mucking about with. But what if you took all of the money that went into plane tickets and Radisson hotels into developing really awesome digital events? Mm-hmm. They're wondering the same thing. This is for the publishing industry as you, your hobby horse about print galleys. Like I think ultimately publishing would like to be able to say to everyone, most of the time the author tour is a loser for everyone involved. Mm-hmm. Let's not do it and try to figure out a way to make the galleys great. You know, get galleys and what is the galley, digital galley version of author events and doing author focused publicity around a title. So there's that one too.
Okay.
Let's see. Those are my three big ones, I guess. I mean, we've talked about this before. This is the most obvious thing in the world, but kids' books, educational books, flying off the shelf. Like literally becoming sentient and flying off the shelves. They're moving them so fast. I didn't hear as much about having trouble with printing as we may have thought.
Oh, that's good.
Based on some of the coverage we've done. So that was interesting as well. Yeah, that's it. Thoughts, okay. Questions, reactions, any surprises there that make sense? Where are you coming from?
That all makes sense. I'm happy to hear cautious optimism. I think that feels true. Publishing is so slow to change on its own that it's interesting to watch an industry that works the way publishing does be forced to make a lot of big changes rapidly and to discover like that it can and that it can do that and not die and like, you know, have made these adaptations and discovered, I think, useful information, like maybe digital events can work really well. Maybe it is much more cost effective to promote books that way than to send authors to 10 cities to stay in 10 different Radisson hotels. Mm-hmm. And the stuff around galleys will be interesting too. You know, I wonder also, like, we've talked in the past about if there were fewer dollars spent acquiring front list books, or what if acquiring editors had to be more like realistic in their, I'm losing terminology. Not
P&Ls,
in the advances that they give. Yeah, that like very. We see a lot more like $1 million advances than we see books that earn out $1 million advances. Mm. So what if that had to become more realistic because most money is made on backlist? So more marketing was going to go to backlist, and you had to like really selectively acquire front list that was good and sellable or that you thought could find an audience. I think that would like, that's a potential interesting shift in publishing. And don't send me your cranky emails about how it's mean to writers if fewer of them get book deals. I don't care.
You know, what's mean to writers publishing their book and sending them to 10 Radissons and it sells 400 copies. I mean, I don't know, which way do you want to be mean?
Or publishing their book and not having any marketing budget besides crossing your fingers and hoping someone will recommend it. Like the number of sales
meetings
say, that
getting slapped on the left cheek is just as bad as getting slapped on the right.
Yeah, the number of sales meetings we've both sat in the last 9 years where people have been like, well, we're not really spending money on that title, but we're hoping it'll get some word of mouth, is like, you want to slave away writing your book for several years and then finally getting a book deal and find out that that's the situation?
Yeah.
I have a weird like reader miscellany thing to share.
Let's do
that
it.
Just came across my dashboard this week that I think might be interesting for folks. So the headline is Literary Puzzle Solved for Just the Third Time in Almost 100 Years.
This is a weird story.
Had you ever heard of this?
No, not until you dropped this link in.
Okay, yeah, I had never heard of this either. So there's this puzzle book called Cain's Jawbone, Cain like Cain and Abel. It was published in 1934, and it was dreamed up by Edward Poes Mathers, who was known as Torquemada and was the Observer's first cryptic crossword inventor. It invites the reader to, so the book has 100 pages, it invites the reader to reorder the book's 100 pages, which means there are more than 32 million possible combinations, and solve the murders within. And since 1934, just two readers have managed to solve the puzzle. Both of them did it in the 1930s, a Mr. S. Sidney Turner and a Mr. W. S. Kennedy. And both of them won £25 for having done it. And now a third person has finally done this. It was republished, I believe, last year. And a a third person has done this. So you can get all the information in this Guardian piece, also by Allison Flood, about Kane's jawbone. It's been published by Unbound. But I was thinking this is kind of perfect for, like, we're going back into winter and there are probably going to be either shutdowns or just more folks adhering to kind of the quarantine lifestyle. Like, you could keep yourself busy for a long time with 32 million combinations of murders to solve in this book. And I really, like, I'm not a murder mystery person. I'm kind of notorious for, like, I'm always surprised at the end of a mystery by who did it. like it's a weird, like, I don't know
the
what
butler
it is.
Who could have thought?
Yeah, like, I guess I can be won over by, or like, I can be captured by
suspension
good
of disbelief. That's good. That's all right. You want?
Yeah,
that.
I can
That's
be great. Captured by good writing in a way that does make it surprising to me, like, who it was going to be. And this is not the thing for me. But I'm sure some of y'all have read a jillion mystery books and would be really good at this. And Unbound is offering a £1,000 prize to anyone who can solve it. So the person who just solved it is named John Finnemore. He's a British comedy writer, and he was one of 12 entrants in this first in the competition. He was the only one to get the answer right. And he just said, this is so, like, typically British understated. It was far and away the most difficult puzzle I've ever attempted.
Wow.
It took him 4 months. He
book
said,
idea. Book idea.
Yeah.
Middle
yeah.
grade. This. No, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but this, and you get to win the great author's inheritance.
Interesting. I like it.
You like it. Yeah.
Yeah. He spent 4 months doing it. He said not continuously, but I had it spread out on the spare bed. So every so often I'd potter in, stare at it till my forehead bled, spend an hour online researching the history of Shrewsbury Prison or something, swap 3 cards, move one back, and potter off again. How anyone solved it before the internet, I cannot imagine.
Damn it. Should we get annotated back out? I feel like there's...
Right?
We could dust it off. Yeah.
Maybe.
There's a lot I want to know.
Yeah, this poem popped up this week. I was like, what? And there's clearly a story here. So yeah. That's Kane's Jawbone, a mystery.
Can you just
in
go buy it?
Million parts.
Can you go get... Can I go... Do I go on Amazon and buy a copy of Kane's Jawbone? Like, what do I do? Where do
Let's,
I start?
Let me see. I mean, it was published by Unbound. Let me see. Let's go to the old Amazon.
I like that Unbound is the name of the publisher when really, literally, you have to move the pages around. Like, you need
it's
to unbound.
It's temporarily out of stock, but probably because everyone was reading this Guardian piece.
Okay,
this week.
There's like a 6% chance it's all hoax. I'm just putting it out there. This is all disinformation. I mean, right? Like 6%. You're taking the over or under on 6% that this is a hoax.
I mean, it's listed on the Unbound website. I'm looking there now.
Sure.
Unbound.com.
Unbound.io, registered in Zimbabwe. Sounds legit.
You can buy it there. It's $30 for the puzzle in a box.
Sure.
$30 for hours and hours of entertainment that will probably have no resolution.
It's probably, you solve it in Ovaltine. It's Ovaltine. For those of you who get that reference.
Oh, that would be so disappointing.
Drink more Ovaltine.
Read more. Solve
read
more,
solve
puzzles.
More puzzles. Yeah,
read subscribe. More books.
No, you know what it would be? Like and subscribe our YouTube channel. That's what you get at the end of.
Make sure to subscribe so you don't miss a new video.
Podcast at bookriot.com, bookriot.com/listen for links to the show notes and this very real mystery book that is super real. Rebecca, we'll talk to you later.
Have a good one.